Midworld, Riverworld, Ringworld, worlds upon worlds. For the sake of zoning and navigation, the oasis had been divided equally into 27 cube-shaped sectors, each containing hundreds of different planets. The three-dimensional map of all 27 sectors distinctly resembled an 80s puzzle toy called a Rubik's Cube. Like most Gunters, I knew this was no coincidence. Each sector measured exactly 10 light hours across, or about 10.8 billion kilometers. So if you were traveling at the speed of light, the fastest speed attainable by any spacecraft inside the oasis, you could get from one side of the sector to the other in exactly 10 hours. That sort of long-distance travel wasn't cheap. Spacecraft that could travel at light speed were rare, and they required fuel to operate. Charging people for virtual fuel to power their virtual spaceships was one of the ways gregarious simulation systems generated revenue, since accessing the oasis was free. But GSS's primary source of income came from teleportation fares. Teleportation was the fastest way to travel, but it was also the most expensive. Traveling around inside the oasis wasn't just costly, it was also dangerous. Each sector was divided up into many different zones that varied in size and shape. Some zones were so large that they encompassed several planets, while others covered only a few kilometers on the surface of a single world. Each zone had a unique combination of rules and parameters. Magic would function in some zones and not in others. The same is true of technology. If you flew your technology-based starship into a zone where technology didn't function, your engines would fail the moment you crossed the zone border. Then you'd have to hire some silly gray-bearded sorcerer with a spell-powered space barge to tow your ass back into a technology zone. Dual zones permitted the use of both magic and technology, and null zones didn't allow either. There were pacifist zones where no player-versus-player combat was allowed, and player-versus-player zones where it was every avatar for themselves. You had to be careful whenever you entered a new zone or sector. You had to be prepared. But like I said, I didn't have that problem. I was stuck at school. Ludus had been designed as a place of learning, so the planet had been created without a single quest portal or gaming zone anywhere on its surface. The only thing to be found here were thousands of identical school campuses separated by rolling green fields, perfectly landscaped parks, rivers, meadows, and sprawling template-generated forests. There were no castles, dungeons, or orbiting space fortresses for my avatar to raid. And there were no NPC villains, monsters, or aliens for me to fight, so there was no treasure or magic items for me to plunder. This totally sucked, for a lot of reasons. Completing quests, fighting NPCs, and gathering treasure were the only ways a low-level avatar like mine could earn experience points, XPs. Earning XPs was how you increased your avatar's power level, strength, and abilities. A lot of Oasis users didn't care about their avatar's power level or bother with the gaming aspects of the simulation at all. They only used the Oasis for entertainment, business, shopping, and hanging out with their friends. These users simply avoided entering any gaming or PvP zones where their defenseless first-level avatars could be attacked by NPCs or by other players. If you stayed in safe zones, like Ludus, you didn't have to worry about your avatar getting robbed, kidnapped, or killed. I hated being stuck in a safe zone. If I was going to find Halliday's egg, I knew I would eventually have to venture out in the dangerous sectors of the oasis. And if I wasn't powerful or well-armed enough to defend myself, I wasn't going to stay alive for very long. Over the past 5 years, I'd managed to slowly, gradually raise my avatar up to third level. This hadn't been easy. I'd done it by hitching rides off-world with other students, mostly H, who happened to be headed to a planet where my wuss avatar could survive. I'd have them drop me near a newbie-level gaming zone and spend the rest of the night or weekend slaying orcs, kobolds, or some other piddly class of monster that was too weak to kill me. For each NPC my avatar defeated, I would earn a few meager experience points and, usually, a handful of copper or silver coins dropped by my slain foes. These coins were instantly converted to credits, which I used to pay the teleportation fare back to Ludus, often just before the final school bell rang. Sometimes, but not often, one of the NPCs I killed would drop an item. That was how I'd obtained my avatar's sword, shield, and armor. I'd stopped hitching rides with H at the end of the previous school year. His avatar was now above 30th level, and so he was almost always headed to a planet where it wasn't safe for my avatar. He was happy to drop me on some noob world along the way, but if I didn't earn enough credits to pay for my fare back to Ludus, I'd wind up missing school because I was stuck on some other planet. This was not an acceptable excuse. I'd now racked up so many unexcused absences that I was in danger of being expelled. If that happened, I would have to return my school-issued Oasis console and visor. Worse, I'd be transferred back to school in the real world to finish out my senior year there. I couldn't risk that. So these days, I rarely left Ludus at all. I was stuck here, and stuck at third level. Having a third level avatar was a colossal embarrassment. None of the other Gunters took you seriously unless you were at least 10th level. Even though I'd been a Gunter since day one, everyone still considered me a noob. It was beyond frustrating. In desperation, I tried to find a part-time after-school job just to earn some walking around money. I applied for dozens of tech support and programming jobs, mostly grunt construction work, coding parts of Oasis malls and office buildings, but it was completely hopeless. Millions of college-educated adults couldn't get one of those jobs. The Great Recession was now entering its third decade, and unemployment was still at a record high. Even the fast food joints in my neighborhood had a 2-year waiting list for job applicants. So I remained stuck at school. I felt like a kid standing in the world's greatest video arcade without any quarters, unable to do anything but walk around and watch the other kids play. Chapter 5. After lunch, I headed to my favorite class, Advanced Oasis Studies. This was a senior year elective where you learned about the history of the Oasis and its creators. Talk about an easy A. For the past 5 years, I'd devoted all of my free time to learning as much as I possibly could about James Halliday. I'd exhaustively studied his life, accomplishments, and interests. Over a dozen different Halliday biographies had been published in the years since his death, and I'd read them all. Several documentary films had also been made about him, and I'd studied those, too. I'd studied every word Halliday had ever written, and I'd played every video game he'd ever made. I took notes, writing down every detail I thought might be related to the hunt. I kept everything in a notebook, which I'd started to call my Grail Diary, after watching the third Indiana Jones film. The more I'd learned about Halliday's life, the more I'd grown to idolize him. He was a god among geeks, a nerd uber-deity on the level of Gygax, Garyo, and Gates. He'd left home after high school with nothing but his wits and his imagination, and he'd used them to attain worldwide fame and amass a vast fortune. He'd created an entirely new reality that now provided an escape for most of humanity. And to top it all off, he'd turned his last will and testament into the greatest video game contest of all time. I spent most of my time in Advanced Oasis Studies class annoying our teacher, Mr. Siders, by pointing out errors in our textbook and raising my hand to interject some relevant bit of Halliday trivia that I, and I alone, thought was interesting. After the first few weeks of class, Mr. Siders had stopped calling on me unless no one else knew the answer to his question. Today, he was reading excerpts from The Eggman, a best-selling Halliday biography that I'd already read four times. During his lecture, I kept having to resist the urge to interrupt him and point out all of the really important details the book left out. Instead, I just made a mental note of each omission, and as Mr. Siders began to recount the circumstances of Halliday's childhood, I once again tried to glean whatever secrets I could from the strange way Halliday had lived his life and from the odd clues about himself he'd chosen to leave behind. James Donovan Halliday was born on June 12, 1972, in Middletown, Ohio. He was an only child. His father was an alcoholic machine operator, and his mother was a bipolar waitress. By all accounts, James was a bright boy, but socially inept. He had an extremely difficult time communicating with the people around him. Despite his obvious intelligence, he did poorly in school because most of his attention was focused on computers, comic books, sci-fi and fantasy novels, movies, and above all else, video games. One day in junior high, Halliday was sitting alone in the cafeteria reading a Dungeons & Dragons player's handbook. The game fascinated him, but he'd never actually played it because he'd never had any friends to play it with. A boy in his class, named Ogden Morrow, noticed what Halliday was reading and invited him to attend one of the weekly D&D gaming sessions held at his house. There, in Morrow's basement, Halliday was introduced to an entire group of mega-geeks just like himself. They immediately accepted him as one of their own, and for the first time in his life, James Halliday had a circle of friends. Ogden Morrow eventually became Halliday's business partner, collaborator, and best friend. Many would later liken the pairing of Morrow and Halliday to that of Jobs and Wozniak or Lennon and McCartney. It was a partnership destined to alter the course of human history. At age 15, Halliday created his first video game, Anorak's Quest. He programmed it in BASIC on a TRS-80 color computer he'd received the previous Christmas, though he'd asked his parents for the slightly more expensive Commodore 64. Anorak's Quest was an adventure game set in Thonia, the fantasy world Halliday had created for his high school Dungeons & Dragons campaign. Anorak was a nickname Halliday had been given by a female British exchange student at his high school. He liked the name Anorak so much that he'd used it for his favorite D&D character, the powerful wizard who later appeared in many of his video games. Halliday created Anorak's Quest for fun, to share with the guys in his D&D gaming group. They all found the game addictive and lost countless hours attempting to solve its intricate riddles and puzzles. Ogden Morrow convinced Halliday that Anorak's Quest was better than most of the computer games currently on the market and encouraged him to try selling it. He helped Halliday create some simple cover artwork for the game, and together, the two of them hand-copied Anorak's Quest onto dozens of 5 1/4-inch floppy disks and stuck them into Ziploc bags, along with a single photocopied sheet of instructions. They began selling the game on the software rack at their local computer store. Before long, they couldn't make copies fast enough to meet the demand. Morrow and Halliday decided to start their own video game company, Gregarious Games, which initially operated out of Morrow's basement. Halliday programmed new versions of Anorak's Quest for the Atari 800XL, Apple II, and Commodore 64 computers, and Morrow began placing ads for the game in the back of several computer magazines. Within 6 months, Anorak's Quest became a national bestseller. Halliday and Morrow almost didn't graduate from high school because they spent most of their senior year working on Anorak's Quest 2. And instead of going off to college, they both focused all of their energy on their new company, which had now grown too large for Morrow's basement. In 1990, Gregarious Games moved into its first real office, located in a rundown strip mall in Columbus, Ohio. Over the next decade, the small company took the video game industry by storm, releasing a series of best-selling action and adventure games, all using a groundbreaking first-person graphics engine created by Halliday. Gregarious Games set a new standard for immersive gaming, and every time they released a new title, it pushed the envelope of what seemed possible on the computer hardware available at the time. The rotund Ogden Morrow was naturally charismatic, and he handled all of the company's business affairs and public relations. At every Gregarious Games press conference, Morrow grinned infectiously from behind his unruly beard and wire-rimmed spectacles, using his natural gift for hype and hyperbole. Halliday seemed to be Morrow's polar opposite in every way. He was tall, gaunt, and painfully shy, and he preferred to stay out of the limelight. People employed by Gregarious Games during this period say that Halliday frequently locked himself in his office, where he programmed incessantly, often going without food, sleep, or human contact for days or even weeks. On the few occasions that Halliday agreed to do interviews, his behavior came off as bizarre, even by game designer standards. He was hyperkinetic, aloof, and so socially inept that the interviewers often came away with the impression he was mentally ill. Halliday tended to speak so rapidly that his words were often unintelligible, and he had a disturbing, high-pitched laugh, made even more so because he was usually the only one who knew what he was laughing about. When Halliday got bored during an interview or conversation, he would usually get up and walk out without saying a word. Halliday had many well-known obsessions. Chief among them were classic video games, sci-fi and fantasy novels, and movies of all genres. He also had an extreme fixation on the 1980s, the decade during which he'd been a teenager. Halliday seemed to expect everyone around him to share his obsessions, and he often lashed out at those who didn't. He was known to fire longtime employees for not recognizing an obscure line of movie dialogue he quoted, or if he discovered they weren't familiar with one of his favorite cartoons, comic books, or video games. Ogden Morrow would always hire the employee back, usually without Halliday ever noticing. As the years went on, Halliday's already stunted social skills seemed to deteriorate even further. Several exhaustive psychological studies were done on Halliday following his death, and his obsessive adherence to routine and preoccupation with a few obscure areas of interest led many psychologists to conclude that Halliday suffered from Asperger's syndrome or from some other form of high-functioning autism. Despite his eccentricities, no one ever questioned Halliday's genius. The games he created were addictive and wildly popular. By the end of the 20th century, Halliday was widely recognized as the greatest video game designer of his generation, and, some would argue, of all time. Ogden Morrow was a brilliant programmer in his own right, but his true talent was his knack for business. In addition to collaborating on the company's games, he masterminded all of their early marketing campaigns and shareware distribution schemes with astounding results. When Gregarious Games finally went public, their stock immediately shot into the stratosphere. By their 30th birthdays, Halliday and Morrow were both multimillionaires. They purchased mansions on the same street. Morrow bought a Lamborghini, took several long vacations, and traveled the world. Halliday bought and restored one of the original DeLoreans used in the Back to the Future films, continued to spend nearly all of his time welded to a computer keyboard, and used his newfound wealth to amass what would eventually become the world's largest private collection of classic video games, Star Wars action figures, vintage lunchboxes, and comic books. At the height of its success, Gregarious Games appeared to fall dormant. Several years elapsed, during which they released no new games. Morrow made cryptic announcements, saying the company was working on an ambitious project that would move them in an entirely new direction. rumors began to circulate that Gregarious Games was developing some sort of new computer gaming hardware, and that this secret project was rapidly exhausting the company's considerable financial resources. There were also indications that both Halliday and Morrow had invested most of their own personal fortunes in the company's new endeavor. Word began to spread that Gregarious Games was in danger of going bankrupt. Then, in December 2012, Gregarious Games rebranded itself as Gregarious Simulation Systems. And under this new banner, they launched their flagship product, the only product GSS would ever release, the OASIS, the ontologically anthropocentric sensory immersive simulation. The OASIS would ultimately change the way people around the world lived, worked, and communicated. It would transform entertainment, social networking, and even global politics. Even though it was initially marketed as a new kind of massively multiplayer online game, the OASIS quickly evolved into a new way of life. In the days before the OASIS, massively multiplayer online games, MMOs, were among the first shared synthetic environments. They allowed thousands of players to simultaneously coexist inside a simulated world, which they connected to via the internet. The overall size of these environments was relatively small, usually just a single world or a dozen or so small planets. MMO players could only see these online environments through a small two-dimensional window, their desktop computer monitor, and they could only interact with it by using keyboards, mice, and other crude input devices. Gregarious Simulation Systems elevated the MMO concept to an entirely new level. The OASIS didn't limit its users to just one planet, or even a dozen. The OASIS contained hundreds, and eventually thousands, of high-resolution 3D worlds for people to explore. And each one was beautifully rendered in meticulous graphical detail, right down to bugs and blades of grass, wind, and weather patterns. Users could circumnavigate each of these planets and never see the same terrain twice. Even in its first primitive incarnation, the scope of the simulation was staggering. Halliday and Morrow referred to the OASIS as an open-source reality, a malleable online universe that anyone could access via the internet using their existing home computer or video game console. You could log in and instantly escape the drudgery of your day-to-day life. You could create an entirely new persona for yourself with complete control over how you looked and sounded to others. In the OASIS, the fat could become thin, the ugly could become beautiful, and the shy, extroverted. Or vice versa. You could change your name, age, sex, race, height, weight, voice, hair color, and bone structure. Or you could cease being human altogether and become an elf, ogre, alien, or any other creature from literature, movies, or mythology. In the OASIS, you could become whomever and whatever you wanted to be without ever revealing your true identity, because your anonymity was guaranteed. Users could also alter the content of the virtual worlds inside the OASIS or create entirely new ones. A person's online presence was no longer limited to a website or a social networking profile. In the OASIS, you could create your own private planet, build a virtual mansion on it, furnish and decorate it however you liked, and invite a few thousand friends over for a party. And those friends could be in a dozen different time zones spread all over the globe. The keys to the success of the OASIS were the two new pieces of interface hardware that GSS had created, both of which were required to access the simulation: the OASIS visor and haptic gloves. The wireless one-size-fits-all OASIS visor was slightly larger than a pair of sunglasses. It used harmless, low-powered lasers to draw the stunningly real environment of the oasis right onto its wearers' retinas, completely immersing their entire field of vision in the online world. The visor was light years ahead of the clunky virtual reality goggles available prior to that time, and it represented a paradigm shift in virtual reality technology. As did the lightweight Oasis haptic gloves, which allowed users to directly control the hands of their avatar and to interact with their simulated environment as if they were actually inside it. When you picked up objects, opened doors, or operated vehicles, the haptic gloves made you feel these non-existent objects and surfaces as if they were really right there in front of you. The gloves let you, as the television ads put it, reach in and touch the oasis. Working together, the visor and the gloves made entering the oasis an experience unlike anything else available. And once people got a taste of it, there was no going back. The software that powered the simulation, Halliday's new Oasis Reality Engine, also represented a huge technological breakthrough. It managed to overcome limitations that had plagued previous simulated realities. In addition to restricting the overall size of their virtual environments, earlier MMOs had been forced to limit their virtual populations, usually to a few thousand users per server. If too many people were logged in at the same time, the simulation would slow to a crawl, and avatars would freeze in mid-stride as the system struggled to keep up. But the Oasis utilized a new kind of fault-tolerant server array that could draw additional processing power from every computer connected to it. At the time of its initial launch, the Oasis could handle up to 5 million simultaneous users with no discernible latency and no chance of a system crash. A massive marketing campaign promoted the launch of the Oasis. The pervasive television, billboard, and internet ads featured a lush green oasis complete with palm trees and a pool of crystal blue water surrounded on all sides by a vast barren desert. GSS's new endeavor was a massive success from day one. The oasis was what people had been dreaming of for decades. The virtual reality they had been promised for so long was finally here. And it was even better than they'd imagined. The Oasis was an online utopia, a holodeck for the home. And its biggest selling point? It was free. Most online games of the day generated revenue by charging users a monthly subscription fee for access. GSS only charged a one-time sign-up fee of 25 cents, for which you received a lifetime Oasis account. The ads all used the same tagline. The Oasis. It's the greatest video game ever created, and it only costs a quarter. At a time of drastic social and cultural upheaval, when most of the world's population longed for an escape from reality, the Oasis provided it. In a form that was cheap, legal, safe, and not medically proven to be addictive. The ongoing energy crisis contributed greatly to the Oasis's runaway popularity. The skyrocketing cost of oil made airline and automobile travel too expensive for the average citizen, and the Oasis became the only getaway most people could afford. As the era of cheap, abundant energy drew to a close, poverty and unrest began to spread like a virus. Every day, more and more people had reason to seek solace inside Halliday and Morrow's virtual utopia. Any business that wanted to set up shop inside the Oasis had to rent or purchase virtual real estate, which Morrow dubbed surreal estate, from GSS. Anticipating this, the company had set aside Sector 1 as the simulation's designated business zone and began to sell and rent millions of blocks of surreal estate there. City-sized shopping malls were erected in the blink of an eye, and storefronts spread across planets like time-lapse footage of mold devouring an orange. Urban development had never been so easy. In addition to the billions of dollars that GSS raked in selling land that didn't actually exist, they made a killing selling virtual objects and vehicles. The Oasis became such an integral part of people's day-to-day social lives that users were more than willing to shell out real money to buy accessories for their avatars, clothing, furniture, houses, flying cars, magic swords, and machine guns. These items were nothing but ones and zeros stored on the Oasis servers, but they were also status symbols. Most items only cost a few credits, but since they cost nothing for GSS to manufacture, it was all profit. Even in the throes of an ongoing economic recession, the Oasis allowed Americans to continue engaging in their favorite pastime, shopping. The Oasis quickly became the single most popular use for the Internet. So much so that the terms Oasis and Internet gradually became synonymous. And the incredibly easy-to-use three-dimensional Oasis OS, which GSS gave away for free, became the single most popular computer operating system in the world. Before long, billions of people around the world were working and playing in the Oasis every day. Some of them met, fell in love, and got married without ever setting foot on the same continent. The lines of distinction between a person's real identity and that of their avatar began to blur. It was the dawn of a new era, one where most of the human race now spent all of their free time inside a video game. Chapter 6. The rest of my school day passed quickly until my final class, Latin. Most students took a foreign language they might actually be able to use someday, like Mandarin or Hindi or Spanish. I decided to take Latin because James Halliday had taken Latin. He'd also occasionally used Latin words and phrases in his early adventure games. Unfortunately, even with the limitless possibilities of the Oasis at her disposal, my Latin teacher, Ms. Rank, still had a hard time making her lessons interesting. And today, she was reviewing a bunch of verbs I'd already memorized, so I found my attention drifting almost immediately. While a class was in session, the simulation prevented students from accessing any data or programs that weren't authorized by their teacher to prevent kids from watching movies, playing games, or chatting with each other instead of paying attention to the lesson. Luckily, during my junior year, I discovered a bug in the school's online library software, and by exploiting it, I could access any book in the school's online library, including Anorak's Almanac. So whenever I got bored, like right now, I would pull it up in a window on my display and read over my favorite passages to pass the time. Over the past 5 years, the Almanac had become my Bible. Like most books nowadays, it was only available in electronic format. But I'd wanted to be able to read the Almanac night or day, even during one of the stack's frequent power outages. So I'd fixed up an old discarded laser printer and used it to print out a hard copy. I put it in an old three-ring binder that I kept in my backpack and studied until I knew every word by heart. The Almanac contained thousands of references to Halliday's favorite books, TV shows, movies, songs, graphic novels, and video games. Most of these items were over 40 years old, and so free digital copies of them could be downloaded from the Oasis. If there was something I needed that wasn't legally available for free, I could almost always get it by using GunTorrent, a file-sharing program used by gunters around the world. When it came to my research, I never took any shortcuts. Over the past 5 years, I'd worked my way down the entire recommended Gunter reading list. Douglas Adams, Kurt Vonnegut, Neal Stephenson, Richard K. Morgan, Stephen King, Orson Scott Card, Terry Pratchett, Terry Brooks, Bester, Bradbury, Haldeman, Heinlein, Tolkien, Vance, Gibson, Gaiman, Sterling, Moorcock, Scalzi, Zelazny. I read every novel by every single one of Halliday's favorite authors, and I didn't stop there. I also watched every single film he referenced in the almanac. If it was one of Halliday's favorites, like War Games, Ghostbusters, Real Genius, Better Off Dead, or Revenge of the Nerds, I rewatched it until I knew every scene by heart. I devoured each of what Halliday referred to as the Holy Trilogies. Star Wars, original and prequel trilogies in that order, Lord of the Rings, The Matrix, Mad Max, Back to the Future, and Indiana Jones. Halliday once said that he preferred to pretend the other Indiana Jones films, from Kingdom of the Crystal Skull onward, didn't exist. I tended to agree. I also absorbed the complete filmographies of each of his favorite directors: Cameron, Gilliam, Jackson, Fincher, Kubrick, Lucas, Spielberg, Del Toro, Tarantino, and of course, Kevin Smith. I spent 3 months studying every John Hughes teen movie and memorizing all the key lines of dialogue. Only the meek get pinched, the bold survive. You could say I covered all the bases. I studied Monty Python, and not just Holy Grail either. Every single one of their films, albums, and books, and every episode of the original BBC series, including those two lost episodes they did for German television. I wasn't going to cut any corners. I wasn't going to miss something obvious. Somewhere along the way, I started to go overboard. I may, in fact, have started to go a little insane. I watched every episode of The Greatest American Hero, Airwolf, The A-Team, Knight Rider, Misfits of Science, and The Muppet Show. What about The Simpsons, you ask? I knew more about Springfield than I knew about my own city. Star Trek? Oh, I did my homework. TOS, TNG, DS9, even Voyager and Enterprise. I watched them all in chronological order. The movies, too. Phasers locked on target. I gave myself a crash course in 80s Saturday morning cartoons. I learned the name of every last goddamn GoBot and Transformer. Land of the Lost, Thundar the Barbarian, He-Man, Schoolhouse Rock, G.I. Joe, I knew them all, because knowing is half the battle. Who was my friend when things got rough? H.R. Puffin Stuff. Japan? Did I cover Japan? Yes. Yes, indeed. Anime and live action. Godzilla, Gamera, Star Blazers, the Space Giants, and G-Force. Go, Speed Racer, go! I wasn't some dilettante. I wasn't screwing around. I memorized every last Bill Hicks stand-up routine. Music? Well, covering all the music wasn't easy. It took some time. The 80s was a long decade, 10 whole years, and Halliday didn't seem to have had very discerning taste. He listened to everything. So I did too. Pop, rock, new wave, punk, heavy metal. From The Police to Journey to REM to The Clash, I tackled it all. I burned through the entire They Might Be Giants discography in under 2 weeks. Devo took a little longer. I watched a lot of YouTube videos of cute, geeky girls playing 80s cover tunes on ukuleles. Technically, this wasn't part of my research, but I had a serious cute, geeky girls playing ukuleles fetish that I can neither explain nor defend. I memorized lyrics. silly lyrics by bands with names like Van Halen, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, and Pink Floyd. I kept at it. I burned the Midnight Oil. Did you know that Midnight Oil was an Australian band with a 1987 hit titled Beds Are Burning? I was obsessed. I wouldn't quit. My grades suffered. I didn't care. I read every issue of every comic book title Halliday had ever collected. I wasn't going to have anyone questioning my commitment, especially when it came to the video games. Video games were my area of expertise, my double weapon specialization, my dream Jeopardy category. I downloaded every game mentioned or referenced in the almanac, from Aklabeth to Zaxxon. I played each title until I had mastered it, then moved on to the next one. You'd be amazed how much research you can get done when you have no life whatsoever. 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, is a lot of study time. I worked my way through every video game genre and platform. Classic arcade coin-ops, home computer, console, and handheld. Text-based adventures, first-person shooters, third-person RPGs. Ancient 8, 16, and 32-bit classics written in the previous century. The harder a game was to beat, the more I enjoyed it. And as I played these ancient digital relics, night after night, year after year, I discovered I had a talent for them. I could master most action titles in a few hours, and there wasn't an adventure or role-playing game I couldn't solve. I never needed any walkthroughs or cheat codes. Everything just clicked. And I was even better at the old arcade games. When I was in the zone on a high-speed classic like Defender, I felt like a hawk in flight, or the way I thought a shark must feel as it cruises the ocean floor. For the first time, I knew what it was to be a natural at something, to have a gift. But it wasn't my research into old movies, comics, or video games that had yielded my first real clue. That had come while I was studying the history of old pen and paper role-playing games. Reprinted on the first page of Anorak's Almanac were the four rhyming lines of verse Halliday had recited in the invitation video. Three hidden keys open three secret gates, wherein the errant will be tested for worthy traits. And those with the skill to survive these straits will reach the end where the prize awaits. At first, this seemed to be the only direct reference to the contest in the entire almanac. But then, buried among all those rambling journal entries and essays on pop culture, I discovered a hidden message. Scattered throughout the text of the almanac were a series of marked letters. Each of these letters had a tiny, nearly invisible notch cut into its outline. I'd first noticed these notches the year after Halliday died. I was reading my hard copy of the almanac at the time, and so at first I thought the notches were nothing but tiny printing imperfections, perhaps due to the paper or the ancient printer I'd used to print out the almanac. But when I checked the electronic version of the book available on Halliday's website, I found the same notches on the same exact letters. And if you zoomed in on one of those letters, the notches stood out as plain as day. Halliday had put them there. He'd marked these letters for a reason. There turned out to be 112 of these notched letters scattered throughout the book. By writing them down in the order they appeared, I discovered that they spelled something. I nearly died of excitement as I wrote it down in my Grail diary. The copper key awaits explorers in a tomb filled with horrors. But you have much to learn if you hope to earn a place among the high scorers. Other Gunters had also discovered this hidden message, of course, but they were all wise enough to keep it to themselves. For a while, anyway. About 6 months after I discovered the hidden message, this loudmouth MIT freshman found it too. His name was Stephen Pendergast, and he decided to get his 15 minutes of fame by sharing his discovery with the media. The news feeds broadcast interviews with this moron for a month, even though he didn't have the first clue about the message's meaning. After that, going public with a clue became known as pulling a Pendergast. Once the message became public knowledge, Gunters nicknamed it the Limerick. The entire world had known about it for almost 4 years now, but no one seemed to understand its true meaning, and the copper key still had yet to be found. I knew Halliday had frequently used similar riddles in many of his early adventure games, and each of those riddles had made sense in the context of its game. So I devoted an entire section of my Grail diary to deciphering the limerick line by line. The copper key awaits explorers. This line seemed pretty straightforward, no hidden meaning that I could detect. In a tomb filled with horrors. This line was trickier. Taken at face value, it seemed to say that the key was hidden in a tomb somewhere, one filled with horrifying stuff. But then, during the course of my research, I discovered an old Dungeons & Dragons supplement called Tomb of Horrors, which had been published in 1978. From the moment I saw the title, I was certain the second line of the limerick was a reference to it. Halliday and Morrow had played Advanced Dungeons & Dragons all through high school, along with several other pen-and-paper role-playing games, like GURPS, Champions, Car Wars, and Rollmaster. Tomb of Horrors was a thin booklet called A Module. It contained detailed maps and room-by-room descriptions of an underground labyrinth infested with undead monsters. D&D players could explore the labyrinth with their characters as the Dungeon Master read from the module and guided them through the story it contained, describing everything they saw and encountered along the way. As I learned more about how these early role-playing games worked, I realized that a D&D module was the primitive equivalent of a quest in the Oasis, and D&D characters were just like avatars. In a way, these old role-playing games had been the first virtual reality simulations, created long before computers were powerful enough to do the job. In those days, if you wanted to escape to another world, you had to create it yourself, using your brain, some paper, pencils, dice, and a few rule books. This realization kind of blew my mind. It changed my whole perspective on the hunt for Halliday's Easter egg. From then on, I began to think of the hunt as an elaborate D&D module. And Halliday was obviously the Dungeon Master, even if he was now controlling the game from beyond the grave. I found a digital copy of the 67-year-old Tomb of Horrors module buried deep in an ancient FTP archive. As I studied it, I began to develop a theory. Somewhere in the Oasis, Halliday had recreated the Tomb of Horrors, and he'd hidden the copper key inside it. I spent the next few months studying the module and memorizing all of its maps and room descriptions in anticipation of the day I would finally figure out where it was located. But that was the rub. The limerick didn't appear to give any hint as to where Halliday had hidden the damn thing. The only clue seemed to be, you have much to learn if you hope to earn a place among the high scorers. I recited those words over and over in my head until I wanted to howl in frustration. Much to learn. Yeah, okay, fine. I have much to learn about what? There were literally thousands of worlds in the oasis. And Halliday could have hidden his recreation of the Tomb of Horrors on any one of them. Searching every planet one by one would take forever, even if I'd had the means to do so. A planet named Gygax in Sector 2 seemed like the obvious place to start looking. Halliday had coded the planet himself, and he'd named it after Gary Gygax, one of the creators of Dungeons & Dragons and the author of the original Tomb of Horrors module. According to Gunterpedia, a Gunter wiki, the planet Gygax was covered with recreations of old D&D modules, but Tomb of Horrors was not one of them. There didn't appear to be a recreation of the tomb on any of the other D&D-themed worlds in the Oasis either. Gunters had turned all of those planets upside down and scoured every square inch of their surfaces. Had a recreation of the Tomb of Horrors been hidden on one of them, it would have been found and logged long ago. So the tomb had to be hidden somewhere else, and I didn't have the first clue where. But I told myself that if I just kept at it and continued doing research, I'd eventually learn what I needed to know to figure out the tomb's hiding place. In fact, that was probably what Halliday meant by, "You have much to learn if you hope to earn a place among the high scorers." If any other Gunters out there shared my interpretation of the limerick, so far they'd been smart enough to keep quiet about it. I'd never seen any posts about the Tomb of Horrors on any Gunter message boards. I realized, of course, that this might be because my theory about the old D&D module was completely lame and totally off base. So I'd continued to watch and read and listen and study, preparing for the day when I finally stumbled across the clue that would lead me to the Copper Key. And then it finally happened, right while I was sitting there daydreaming in Latin class. Chapter 7. Our teacher, Ms. Rank, was standing at the front of the class, slowly conjugating Latin verbs. She said them in English first, then in Latin, and each word automatically appeared on the board behind her as she spoke it. Whenever we were doing tedious verb conjugation, I always got the lyrics to an old Schoolhouse Rock song stuck in my head. To run, to go, to get, to give. Verb, you're what's happening. I was quietly humming this tune to myself when Ms. Rank began to conjugate the Latin for the verb to learn. To learn, dissere, she said. Now, this one should be easy to remember because it's similar to the English word discern, which also means to learn. Hearing her repeat the phrase to learn was enough to make me think of the limerick. You have much to learn if you hope to earn a place among the high scorers. Ms. Rank continued, using the verb in a sentence. We go to school to learn, she said. Petimus, scolum, ut literas, discamus. And that was when it hit me. Like an anvil falling out of the sky, directly onto my skull. I gazed around at my classmates. What group of people has much to learn? Students. High school students. I was on a planet filled with students, all of whom had much to learn. What if the limerick was saying that the tomb was hidden right here on Ludus, the very planet where I'd been twiddling my thumbs for the past 5 years? Then I remembered that Ludus was also a Latin word meaning school. I pulled up my Latin dictionary to double-check the definition, and that was when I discovered the word had more than one meaning. Ludus could mean school, but it could also mean sport or game. Game. I fell out of my folding chair and landed with a thud on the floor of my hideout. My Oasis console tracked this movement and attempted to make my avatar drop to the floor of my Latin classroom, but the classroom conduct software prevented it from moving, and a warning flashed on my display. Please remain seated during class. I told myself not to get too excited. I might be jumping to conclusions. There were hundreds of private schools and universities located on other planets inside the Oasis. The limerick might refer to one of them. But I didn't think so. Ludus made more sense. James Halliday had donated billions to fund the creation of the Oasis public school system here as a way to demonstrate the huge potential of the Oasis as an educational tool. And prior to his death, Halliday had set up a foundation to ensure that the Oasis public school system would always have the money it needed to operate. The Halliday Learning Foundation also provided impoverished children around the globe with free Oasis hardware and internet access so that they could attend school inside the Oasis. GSS's own programmers had designed and constructed Ludus and all of the schools on it, so it was entirely possible that Halliday was the one who'd given the planet its name. And he would also have had access to the planet's source code if he'd wanted to hide something here. The realizations continued to detonate in my brain like atomic bombs going off, one after another. According to the original D&D module, the entrance to the Tomb of Horrors was hidden near a low, flat-topped hill, about 200 yards wide and 300 yards long. The top of the hill was covered with large black stones that were arranged in such a way that if you viewed them from a great height, they resembled the eye sockets, nose holes, and teeth of a human skull. But if there was a hill like that hidden somewhere on Ludus, wouldn't someone have stumbled across it by now? Maybe not. Ludus had hundreds of large forests scattered all over its surface, in the vast sections of empty land that stood between the thousands of school campuses. Some of these forests were enormous, covering dozens of square miles. Most students never even set foot inside them because there was nothing of interest to do or see there. Like its fields and rivers and lakes, Ludus's forests were just computer-generated landscaping placed there to fill up the empty space. Of course, during my avatar's long stay on Ludus, I'd explored a few of the forests within walking distance of my school out of boredom. But all they contained were thousands of randomly generated trees and the occasional bird, rabbit, or squirrel. These tiny creatures weren't worth any experience points if you killed them. I'd checked. So, it was entirely possible that somewhere, hidden in one of Ludus's large, unexplored patches of forest land, there was a small, stone-covered hill that resembled a human skull. I tried pulling up a map of Ludus on my display, but I couldn't. The system wouldn't let me because class was still in session. The hack I used to access books in the school's online library didn't work for the Oasis Atlas software. Shit! I blurted out in frustration. The classroom conduct software filtered this out, so neither Ms. Rank nor my classmates heard it. But another warning flashed on my display. Profanity muted. Misconduct warning. I looked at the time on my display. Exactly 17 minutes and 20 seconds left until the end of the school day. I sat there with clenched teeth and counted off each second, my mind still racing. Ludus was an inconspicuous world in Sector 1. There wasn't supposed to be anything but schools here, so this was the last place a Gunter would think to look for the Copper Key. It was definitely the last place I had ever thought to look, and that alone proved it was a perfect hiding place. But why would Halliday have chosen to hide the Copper Key here? Unless... He'd wanted a school kid to find it. I was still reeling from the implications of that thought when the bell finally rang. Around me, the other students began to file out of the room or vanish in their seats. Ms. Rank's avatar also disappeared, and in moments, I was all alone in the classroom.